about your money.
Penny. Or anything. We tried. We really, we attempted to get them in life.
So I mentioned the fleet. It was the creature on the earth that goes the farthest distance for its mass, does so with very little muscle tissue whatsoever. And this is from the paper, Sutton's paper, on the mechanical model of the jumping fleet. So the ground reaction force is the arrow, and the fleet center of mass is located at the top. And this resilient pad is this elastic element that they have, like a big rubber band. And so they will hunker down when they land on your puppy's skin, and they will use their front legs where the most of their muscle mass is, and they'll push themselves backwards, and in doing so, change the orientation of their coxa and their femur. And when they do that, they stretch the rubber band, sorry, this compresses the rubber band, into a shorter position. And then when they are ready, you see the ground reaction force now is angled about 45 degrees. So the force will be propelling that fleet in that direction as soon as they change their position and the catch mechanism lets go and boom, they're gone. So the moral is... And this one right here is actually compresses.
So these are rubber band, I think, like pull it.
Yeah, it's a spring. I always use springs and rubber bands together. I should. So yeah, so it's a spring system. The rubber band is too. But... So this is the position here, you can see that because the femur being pushed up into an acute angle, the spring is compressed. Okay. And the moral of the story is, a tiny little muscle produces a great deal of power in a flea. So muscle mass, muscle size, isn't what's most important when it comes to function, movement, or power production in muscle. So I showed you some jumping frogs before. Again, this is from fourth place, we have ground reaction force, and we instrumented the frogs with a whole bunch of hardware in the planetary's muscle. And apparently frogs don't have gastrops, they just have planetary's muscles. Just like mice still have planetary's muscles. They have flexor dysfunction and facialis muscles that they call. So, you'll notice right here, the wires come down into this muscle. There's two crystals in there, some of my chromatin crystals that are transmitting that sound back and forth that give real-time feedback as to position between them. And they will give, they'll give us back muscle lengths. We have those in one of the fascicles in the muscle. There's also EMG for muscle activation. And then there's these force transducers in there. And these go around the tendon like an E-buckle. And then when the tendon gets stiffer and it deforms the buckle deforms, there's resistance sensors on the back side of the buckle that sends a changing output of voltage. And we calibrate that to be force, so we get muscle force, which is what you can't get in humans. You get force, muscle activation, and muscle length and ground reaction force. And then kinematics on the video for the jumping frog.
So is the one on top like made for rats and you made one for frogs?
So if the one up here, this one was used on a cat. This one is for the frog. We made a smaller one for rats upstairs in the lab, and we also have one for rabbits too. And the bigger ones, we have some actually that are bigger than this one as well. We made out of titanium to get the buckles stamped with the hand. Then you file them down, sand them down, get them nice and smooth, and then instrument them with the gauges on the end of the back bone. You excite them with about 10 volts DC current, and then when they bend, the resistance changes so the output's different. And the output change is what you calibrate to actual force. You calibrate it with mass, grams. Everybody likes to see it again on our early Monday morning jumping frog. To refresh your memory in case you forgot what that looked like. Next place. I'm supposed to. Gets to the top of it. And lands on his face.
I just don't get what they don't know.
But it sounded it. Yeah, that's just... milliseconds into the jump. So within 72 milliseconds of the frog taking off, the peak force that's being produced by the muscle via that buckle is about 72 milliseconds in. And at the end, peak force reduction is about 104 milliseconds. He's already in the air. So he's done everything he has to do in 100 milliseconds to be able to get as far as he goes. So let me see if we can decipher what the frog did and how we can take advantage of that in real life. So, Pal, the ability to do work over a short duration of time, force and velocity, work and time. So peak power takes place about 72 milliseconds. We have fascicle power and fascicle power per kilogram. So that's normalized to the mass of the frogs compared to the frogs. The fascicle power is, we know the velocity of that muscle fiber because we have those sonomicrometry crystals in there. So those fibers are actually shortening when the frog starts to jump. And we know the duration of time it takes to do that. So we have force, we have work, and we have time. And that's how we calculated power. And we called it fascicle power because we really don't know. We make an assumption that every single muscle fiber in that muscle is doing the same thing. Right? Because we can only measure a location on that muscle. It's a decent, probably relatively valid assumption that we assume that those fibers are all doing similar things. So we're hoping that fascicle power then translates out to work and power for the whole muscle as well. We make that assumption. So we have muscle power as well. Muscle power does not peak at the same time fascicle power does. And that was the first interesting revelation in how the system works, is that muscle power and peak power are not the same thing when it comes to fascicle, fiber work, and overall muscle. So when I say muscle from now on, I refer to the whole contractile element of muscle. And if I want to talk about muscle with its tendon, I'll say muscle tendon unit or MTU, because they are two separate entities, even though they're in series with each other. Because they work together, but they don't work synchronously. And that's the important aspect of how tendons work. So muscle power is the true power of the muscle. And if I overlay those things, you'll see power of fascicle muscle with color tickling match up to the actual. We'll highlight that, we'll overlay them. So here's the difference in the heat. This is a blue purplish, if you will, is muscle, and fascicle is going to be in the green. And what you'll notice is that they're offset from each other and there's a delay. And the reason why there's a delay in between the power output of the fascicle, of the actual muscle fiber fascicles actually producing power, and the whole muscle, is because of the length change and the timing of the length change between the fascicle and the muscle. So there's this. In mechanics of movement, there is this thing referred to as power optimization. Power optimization is the ability of your internal system, of your muscle and your series elastic and your parallel elastic elements, to work in synchrony so that the elastic elements store and give back energy to the system. Now, power optimization is the series and parallel elastic systems in your muscle tendon unit that will store energy and give it back to you. Optimize performance. So, can't be able to make a lot of screens. So when we talked before about Hill's model of muscle, this is Hill's model of muscle. In a diagram, this is Hill's model of muscle, A.B. Hill's model, the same guy from the force velocity relationship. This is tendon anchored to bone. This is tendon anchored to bone. This one actually is a long tendon that has an elastic element, so it's a spring. So again, these are springs. The way muscle is put together is that you have a contractile element, which right here serves to be your sarcomeres, right? Muscle fibers and sarcomeres. And there's also, when things are linked together like a chain, right? They're called in series. So you have an in series element, SEC, which is an in series elastic element. And you have, C stands for component, series elastic component. And you also have a tendon that's in series as well. The thing about elements that are in series is that they all have to share the same load. It's a really important aspect of what in series actually means. It's back to that whole, you're only as strong as your weakest link because you have to share the same load. In a system that has a force-reduced bidding, this has to carry that load, this has to carry that load, and that load gets transferred to bones either side of it. So, this is tendon. This is the compliance of cross bridges, which surprisingly actually do store a lot of energy in vacuum. And actin and myosin. Possibly titan, we'll talk about that in a moment. So those are all nice because they'll give you some storage and return of energy. Then you also have this parallel elastic element too, which is your extracellular matrix, right? Just all the collagens, all the connective tissue of your muscle. Challenge with tight is the way to put it. That's why I kind of put it in the parallel elastic there. So parallel elastic. So again, we talk about series and parallel organizations. A series element can only share the load with its neighbors. It's not going to add anything to it. It's just going to store and give back. But it can't ever have more energy or force in it than its neighbor does, otherwise it'll pull apart. So if this produces 100 newtons of force, the most force this can feel or transmit to this one too has to be 100 newtons. It can't give anything more. It can store the 100 newtons and give it back to you when you run out later. That's energy return, but it can't make energy. The extracellular component can't either, but the extracellular component can add, though, to the force of your contractile element. And as we talked about last week with the parallel or series arrangement of batteries, you can arrange them in one way so that you have more amperage, you can arrange them in another way, you have more voltage, you can do different things. So parallel systems are additive, which means you can actually have an additional amount of force on top of the contractile element. And we know that because when we stretch somebody's hamstring or something of the sort, we get to a point that we're getting greater and greater force. That force is being restricted from parallel elastic elements. So that's how it gets added together as you move through the range of motion. So when we have a system like this, and we're going to try to take advantage of this system to optimize power in muscle, we know a lot about this to study forever. It's the easiest thing to study because it's attached to the muscle. You can see it, you can play with it, you can manipulate it, you can poke at it, you can measure it. These things in here are a lot more difficult to measure. But these things in here are likely more important. And the current area of research in this world, trying to understand carbonization, isn't as much about tendons as it is about the contribution of these other parts inside the muscles, and how they might contribute, and how do frogs and other jumping animals and wallabies, how do they take advantage of that system better than we do? Another question. Don't go adopt a wallaby.
Huh?
Don't adopt a wallaby.
I have.
I know you did.
I was adopted for a wallaby.
What?
They moved.
Wallaby's still with us, though, tonight.
Oh, there's a breeder. So, yes, because they're herbivores, not carnivores.
So,
she got big. They just seem like freaky big. Freaky
that? No.
Oh, they're wallabies. She had to wear a diaper.
In our system, what happens here is that, again, we have a muscle, drive element, with an in-series arrangement of elastic elements, and an in-series tendon, a very long one, and then we have this parallel arrangement. So what happens here is that when you can break up the muscle and the muscle tendon used as a whole, and also separate out the fascicle, you notice the fascicle length change. This is the length on the left-hand side. The fascicle starts to shorten quickly because it's activated. Remember, all sarcomeres know to do is to shorten. All cross bridges do is attach and pull. So when you activate a sarcomere, it's going to shorten if it can, as long as the external load is not too great. But as that sarcomere shortens and all the fibers start to shorten, you notice the blue line stays the same length. It stays the same 100% normalized length for about another 40 seconds. And in this regard, it's because the entire muscle tendon length itself has not changed, because the frog hasn't moved yet. As the muscle fascicles are being activated and they're shortening inside the frog, while the frog is sitting there and you don't think he's doing anything yet, 40 milliseconds, he's actually preparing to jump and he's actually starting to jump, and you don't even see it, he's not moving yet. And while he's doing that, the muscle contractile element is shortening. The tendon's elongating while the muscle shortens, and all the energy that the muscle is producing is being stored inside that tendon. Now this is the most, I won't say it's the least efficient sort of power optimization. It's the most studied mode of power optimization, which is utilization of your tendon. And it gives you back some really good energy. But the tendons, they're so good at giving you back energy, they can give you back between 95 and 100% of the energy you put in them. Certain tendons, healthy tendons, long tendons, have the ability to give back to you what you put in them 95-100%. That's really efficient. But the system, like I said before, inside the muscle is probably more important. But what happens here, we know with the tendon at least, is that for 40 milliseconds, that tendon is being stretched. My favorite diagram in the world, force, change in length, elastic system. Tendons aren't elastic, they're viscoelastic, but they're pretty elastic. So this may be an overrepresentation of its elasticity, but when you stretch a tendon out to, say, 5% of its normal length, you are going to be storing that much energy in that tendon, because it takes that much energy to stretch it that far.
So it's directly proportional. You don't lose any of that energy.
In a purely elastic system, you do not. In a purely elastic spring, in a purely elastic system, an element like a rubber band, for instance, until they get really old and start breaking down, you're always getting back 100% of the energy you put back in. And that's why it's linear. In real life, what you actually get is something that probably looks more like this than this. Just on the return, that and the way out. missing here is energy that's lost, heat dissipation, etc. That's called a hysteresis loop, and that's more physiologically representative of what tissues actually do in the vehicle. But for our purposes today, and for your purposes on the exam and anything else, it's not uncommon to model a tendon as an elastic element when it comes to stuff like this. It's actually easier. Because otherwise, that model over there I drew for you, the Hill model, you have to put in a whole bunch of things called dashpots. And anybody ever have a car that the shock absorbers stopped working on? And then when you hit a bump, what happens? It just keeps on bouncing. That's because you've removed the absorber of shock, the viscous portion of your shock system. And all you have left is the elastic portion called the spring. So one of the reasons why these systems don't work as springs is because, again, you would have constant elasticity, and you have all this recoiling energy out of control a lot of times. The system that's viscoelastic adds a shock absorber into your spring. So you're like your car, you push on it, it comes back to where it was. Slowly, but it comes back to where it was and stays there. But you can model them as purely elastic elements like this with a straight line. It's easier to obviously to say, if you think there's the energy I'm getting. Otherwise, the energy you put in is here. The energy you're getting out is there. Right. And there's that loss of 5% that tendons probably do. Diagram that for you again. This is the contractile element. This is called a straight line model of muscle, so there's no parallel elastic elements in here. It's just a contractile element and the tendon, just a series elastic element. Simplest model you can make. And when the frog is sitting there, looking for a fly, and he's hanging out there, so the length of your muscle and the length of your spring. And you'll notice that within 40 milliseconds, the length of the muscle and the spring stay the same. But the contractile element is shortened, and that has engaged the spring and length of your spring. So, muscle has shortened, therefore, the spring has been stretched out and now has a certain amount of energy in it. So then when the frog decides to take off, you can take advantage of that because now you have not only the muscle that's going to start to continue to contract, I should say start, to continue contracting. It's also going to be contracting it with the assistance of the spring that is now stretched out. It's going to also give greater velocity to that movement. Right? So you have a loaded spring in series with your muscle working together, and that increases the velocity of movement and power. Does that make sense? How many molecules of ATP does one cross-bridge cycle utilize? Remember, one. And if you have 10 million cross-bridges in the course of a muscle of a frog that's trying to jump and they're all using one ATP of energy to produce force and they're cycling multiple times, that's a lot of ATP utilization. And it's a lot of heat production, and it's a lot of metabolites and soon-to-be fatigue, right? Yeah, we can go running for 26 miles, right? I can't. Maybe once. Not recently. Anybody run long distances in here and enjoy it? So you can, if you have. You can go for a jog around the block. You know, out hiking, you run into a bear, you can run away from it. And often not have to stop and rest for your ATP to be reconnoitered. One of the efficiencies of locomotion, the reason why people have different efficiencies of movement, you put somebody on a walkway or a treadmill, let them run, they will select their own stride length, stride frequency, and velocity of movement. Right? It's been known for a long time. Gait's pretty well studied. One of the things one of the reasons people do that is because they have their own system and they have their own, whether they know it or not, the ability to utilize utilize their tendons appropriately and effectively between the inertia of their lower extremity, their mass, their stride length. They take advantage of these systems. When you go for a run around the block, whether it's from a bear or just for fun, whatever that is, running for fun, I used to run because it was just good for you. I had basketball in there.
What? One of the women from the United States said a 2-minute PR, like 2:20 marathon. That's crazy.
It's an impressive thing. What the human body can do, functioning performance-wise, is an amazing thing. I find running to be some of the most boring things I ever do. And watching it might be one of the most boring things. Doing it might be the second most boring thing. I need to be distracted by things. So, but that is one of the bottom lines. One of the most important things about gait is that there's an efficiency, and oftentimes it's mechanical. When you try to force people or force subjects to run beyond or below their efficiency, you are wasting their energy, and they are not comfortable, and they can get injured, but also they are going to fatigue rapidly. One of the reasons being is the gastrocnemius, when you run, isolates basically as an isometric contraction. Once you get moving, the reason why it's not so fatiguing to run, because how many people have gastroc fatigue when they go for a run? And it's a fast twitch muscle, right? I mean, it should fatigue rather rapidly. And if the thing had to cycle to produce plantar flexion, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion, dorsiflexion all the time, that's a lot of cross bridges, cycling, shortening, relaxing, cycling, shortening, and that's a lot of ATP use. But it doesn't happen because you have this really long structure in the back of your leg called an Achilles tendon. It's thick and it's long for a reason. And it will store that energy, and all your gastroc has to do basically is just control the length of it. Acts as a servo system.
That's why you get so much more sore when you're in the sand.
Ugh. Miserable. Try it once. That wasn't pleasant or boring. That was just short. You actually have to push.
Yeah.
And it is miserably time-consuming and taxing on the system. But when you don't, and you can actually bound along, and bounding, prancercise, whatever you want to call it. I've seen the YouTube videos. You just bound along and you take advantage of the system. You take advantage of the elasticity that's stored in those series elastic elements. I say this in muscle mechanics class every year. Just go to the zoo and watch the wallaby. The wallaby is an amazing creature, as you know. But the wallaby, the nature's kangaroo's little cousin, has really long lever arms and feet, has really, 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 really long tendons in the back of its leg, and has really small little muscles. So when the wallaby wants to start moving, and he has to actually use his gastrocnemius plantaris as a true concentric force-generating structure, it's painful to watch him start moving because his tendons are so long and so elastic that when the muscle contracts, the tendons elongate. And so when he first starts moving, he's like... because the force isn't being transmitted as easily as it should be, right? So instead of the muscle shortening and the foot plantar flexing, the muscle shortens, the tendon elongates, the foot goes. So it takes a while for him to get going, but once he gets going and he can modulate that length of that tendon, they are incredibly efficient at varying their speed of hopping just by contracting their muscles a tiny fraction of a bit, holding them isometrically. And they bounce along that. Very fast. So if you want to outrun a wallaby, do it in the first 10 seconds. It's more of a story.
This is kind of neat with, I think, the prosthetics. You know, you see those artificial legs that have that, that roundness to it.
At the bottom. So when I first saw those, because those were relatively new in the last half of it, 20 years or so, right? 20 years or so. Before that, they were just the anatomical looking foot that was kind of, it seemed like it was clumsy whenever you saw people use it. And when I saw, the first time I saw that blade, utilized at the bottom of a prosthesis. I grew up on a dairy farm, and it's the exact same structure as a hay rake. They used to pull behind the tractor. They were curved, they were long, you know? Yeah. And they'd come along, and you'd rake, and they were springy. They were there for a reason. They were built that way so that if you caught something, it would spring back and back up there and keep on going. And they put those on the bottom of those, and people ran fast.
right? Real fast. There is a guy who's selling a product that's a boot that you put in the bottom of your shoe, and it is a big, it's a big elastic lever that goes in the bottom of your feet. It's funny looking, probably dangerous, but he runs really fast with it. So if you want one of those, you can find one of those online. But it's a big boot that has this really long lever. It's almost like the prosthetic, but it's even bigger than that, and you can run that. For, they're called something really weird. To take advantage of the same kind of system.
But did you see where the Army paid some dude a whole bunch of money for his patent? He had something that was a compression that was storing energy, and it could recharge your batteries. So you could put a battery pack on your shoe, and it was actually storing energy.
Oh, yeah.
And the Army bought his patent out, but they don't sell it out to the public.
So it would be interesting.
But what a neat idea.
That is interesting. Larry Rome, you know Larry Rome?
No. Mm-hmm.
Doug Stein? Mm-hmm. Doug Stein? Larry Rome of the blowfish, the boatfish, the bowfish. And he did studies on the bowfish muscles and swimming sharks and everything. Does a lot of his own jumping frog stuff and rattlesnakes. Because he's an experimental biologist who studies muscle, because not because he wants to cure disease, but because it's cool. And Larry Rome made an energy storing backpack. So the thing had springs and an energy storage system, so that when you walked, and as you know, when you walk, the thing goes, don't you have that efficiency, and the bag goes. Well, he took advantage of that, and he made a spring-loaded, energy-absorbing, elastic component system that gives you back the energy that you actually put into your backpack. And he also did that for the military. That was military.
Maybe
military.
It's him.
Could be.
Maybe it's the same person. Yeah.
Maybe all kinds of people in the military. So there's ways to store energy and get it back in some way. By doing that, taking advantage of your tendon, you increase the power of your output. You didn't read this for this class. Griffiths, 1991, was the first person to show that your tendon and your muscle were dissociated from each other. It wasn't long after that we tried to publish a paper during eccentric exercise that showed that the muscle and the tendon were dissociated, and it got rejected 3 times because people said it wasn't true. It was a big pain in the butt. Because if you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense initially that when a muscle shortens, a tendon lengthens. And when a muscle lengthens, a tendon shortens. But that's exactly what happens in vivo when we move. But the problem was nobody ever measured it in vivo until Griffiths came up and measured it in 1991. Everybody had these things in petri dishes. And the system was allowed to shorten and lengthen as it needed to. And no one watched the system actually work the way it was made to work. So what we learned from that back then was that if a muscle goes through a two-phase length change, which means if I start right here in full extension of my biceps brachii, and I have muscle in a lengthened position, and I go from short to long, from long to short, to an eccentric contraction back to long, I've gone through, I'm going to call it two-phase length change, to short and long, for muscle, the muscle contractile element itself, the muscle tendon unit. The tendon's gone through a four-phase length change. The tendon's changed length 4 times. So as soon as I contract muscle and I keep it right here at full extension, just like the frog for 40, 70 milliseconds, I contract my muscle. My tendon now is longer, my muscle is shorter. And now, as my muscle continues to shorten, my tendon is now coming along for the ride. And when I get here, I start to overload it with a load that's heavier, so it's an eccentric contraction. My muscle now maintains an isometric contraction, and the first bit of length change comes from my tendon alone. And that lengthens first, and then the muscle gives, and then the rest of it goes through together. So, I think I have something. Of what is power optimization. And
As soon as we let me know, we're here in the corner. So this will be joint angle. And this will be, we'll go with tendon first. No, we'll go with muscle first. Sorry. Just a muscle contractile element. So if I have a joint angle here, I'm just going to call, let's just use the ankle for instance. And we'll utilize a jump from 90 degree ankle, standing upright, this position, and we'll start with 100% as optimal length of the contractile element. When you start to shorten your muscle, joint angle stays the same. Right? That's that first part we talked about, just like with the frog back here. And at some point in time, angle starts to shorten as well. Sorry, angle starts to go up, I'm just going to jump. And then the muscle continues downward. Now, as this thing, as your joint angle continues to change, as you're going from standing to jumping upward, so your plantar flexing, so your joint angle is getting larger. While that's happening, your muscle actually starts to plateau because your tendons are now recoiling in this whole system. So a lot of the energy and a lot of the motion then is actually taken up by the tendon. Now the difference is when you land from that jump, that's called power attenuation. That's the exact opposite system. Power attenuation is because your tendons now, when you land, are going to absorb the initial energy and power of the impact and the transference of that energy to your system. So when you land and your joint angle rapidly comes back to reality, your contractile element isn't as rapidly stretched back, it goes back slowly. Because in here, the tendon is being elongated, so your muscle does not have to be. And in here, the tendon is being elongated. Your muscle doesn't have to be. In one of these, the tendon absorbs the energy from the environment, so your muscle doesn't have to do it. In power optimization, your tendon absorbs the energy from your muscle, so it can give it back to you later. That's why it optimizes. I talked to a guy about horse racing last year. He told me the way that they select the horses that are going to win, and the way they put the horses, select the horses to spend millions of dollars on, is they walk behind the horse and they go, "Feels like this one." That's it. And they say 1 in 10 times they have success because it's really, it's a crapshoot. They don't know. The horse looks nice. They have no idea about any of the parameters or anything that they can say about that horse, mechanically, biologically, physiologically, that's going to make the horse win. They walk behind it, they pat him on the butt, they look at it, and they say, "We'll take it." I think that when you walk around and you watch people run, you can tell who's going to be an athlete who isn't going to be pretty quickly. And a lot of it is because of the size of their shank, which is the lower portion of their leg. Inertia at the lower extremity is an incredible resistance to movement. And watch a lot of people that actually have the ability to run fast or the bound. They don't have huge calves. They don't have tiny little Achilles tendons. They don't have huge Achilles tendons. They have skinny ankles and they have tiny little tendons. But you think, how can that supply or support all that force being generated through there when they go bounding through the air and running all the time? But without having that mass in your lower extremity, you have less inertia to overcome every time you take a step, and that is hugely efficient. So the thing about these kinds of systems is that architecturally, when it comes to muscle, you don't have to have a huge, huge, huge muscle to produce adequate force to stretch a tendon. That allows you to have very long skinny tendons like a wallaby in the shank of your leg, decreases the inertia that it takes for you to move that thing every time you swing it going for a run, and still be able to have a muscle large enough to generate the force to optimize that tendon length. And that's the miracle of this whole system, I think. And it kind of brings us towards architecture of muscle, which is kind of where we want to go. So is everybody okay with this? Of all the things that biomechanists, biomedical engineers have tried to do, is they tried to model the efficiency of movement. A lot of times, as Robin said, you know, for patients in need of prostheses, etc. And my understanding and what I've read is the best model that anybody comes up with is a mass spring system. It's a mass with a spring, and that models human movement better than anything else. Something simple, mass and spring. So a mass spring system, if you ever see that, is simply this right here. It's turned 90 degrees so that gravity is your friend, compresses your spring, and you have mass and spring.
But you kind of think about the whole sensory system involved here too.
Yeah.
The whole tendon organ,
mm-hmm.
and how it could respond
yeah.
to this tendon stretch, but the muscle's not. Wow, that's weird.
The Golgi always confused me because muscle spindles to me are a fascinating thing. Because we haven't talked much about sensory organs in muscle or tendon, but spindles optimize force production, hence you're getting your reflexes tested. You stretch that tendon, that little dinky bit, that stretch of the tendon, that stretch of the muscle causes the muscle to contract. That's how sensitive that system is, and that's a spindle. As Robin was talking about, the Golgi tendon organs are in their tendons, and they actually are inhibitory to muscle function. So when you overload that, it causes the muscle to shut down. But somehow they always work together.
Yeah, but you'd think with the tendon being stretched so much, but the muscle's not
yeah.
contracting yet, but it can't, doesn't want to shut it down.
Right.
You want to allow it. So at that point, it's
yeah.
still working very well.
But yeah, so I still don't understand how Golgi tendon organs didn't work.
It'd be neat if somebody measured it during this. I don't know if anybody's measured it like during this whole movement
well, I don't know.
Process. That would be neat.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
I have no idea.
Should get some jumping frogs.
We should. That'd be fun.
And by the way, if you ever want to suture anything that's really difficult, suture frog skin. That's
super cool.
Great paper. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this chapter, I know you, a lot of people had questions about what you know out of this chapter. There's a lot of stuff in this chapter, right? There's a lot about movement. So we talked about torque and moments, moment arms for every muscle of the lower extremity. Those types of things, don't worry about. They're there if you ever want them. And trust me, if you stay in research in muscle, you will want them one day because you're what the hell is that moment arm? You're Dr. Magnus. And it'll be in this book. But it's not something that I would worry about because moment arms aren't static. So the moment arm for the adductor magnus at rest is different than the moment arm for the adductor magnus when you have hip abduction and hip adduction. It depends on where the position of the joint is, the moment arm changes all the time. So those numbers are averages usually. I will tell you that the average moment arm of a New Zealand white rabbit, tibialis anterior, is 11 millimeters. I measured it a lot. But it changes all the way through the entire range of motion. And it makes sense. If you think about the moment arm being the perpendicular distance of the axis of rotation to the tendon line of function, you know, when I fully extend my elbow, you know, my bicep tendon gets really close to my elbow and gets closer to my axis of rotation. My moment arm has gotten much shorter here than it is out here. So it changes the entire range of motion. Torque is cross product of force and moment arm. This isn't a biomechanics class. I'm not worried about that, right, per se. And it's essential to know movement in that regard, but that's what a moment is. And so that's all I think you need to know about moments right now, because we're not going to go through all the biomechanics of it all. I think the things that we'll talk about are here are actually things that we think are more important, so these are the most important aspects of it. Okay? So this idea of optimization, of this idea of tendons storing energy, and how muscle is put together for function is going to be important. So I want to show you right now. Cool. Anybody that knows anything about muscle knows they're not all built exactly the same. And in fact, one of the things that that you'll notice if you ever start looking at muscle is that synergists, or muscles that always work together, come in pairs. They generally come in pairs. And they come in pairs because I hope what you'll understand when we get through this thing, if we get through this thing, is that to have one muscle that does everything would make that muscle so large you would weigh 30 or 40% more than you do right now just to do the same things you're doing today. By taking muscles and dividing and conquering with function, by splitting them up to different forms optimized for that function, you save yourself about 30% of your mass. Now, this kind of goes along with what I just said a minute ago. You can get a long, skinny tendon with a tiny little muscle and have it optimized to that storage of energy. But you don't always want to have that long, skinny tendon with a tiny little muscle, because you don't want to be like the wallaby that has to try to start walking. But wallabies don't walk, so they're not concerned about it. They hop. But you walk, and you hop. So you want both. You want the best of both worlds, right? Some people hop, some people scotch. I verb it myself.
How long have you been waiting?
You're all week, folks. Try the meal.
That was a while coming
out. I got a lot.
Yeah.
So, to optimize that, then, we need to have different structures. There are, and your textbook puts this in there, multiple different architectural types. Parallel arrangement of muscle is not that common in this world, but it is possible to have a parallel arrangement. Basically, what these arrangements are at the end of the day is... If I have a line of pull of a tendon in this direction, and a line of pull in this direction, I would like to optimize if utilization of my muscle contractile properties is of utmost concern. It'd be nice if my muscle was oriented in a way that as it produced force and shortened, 100% of all that force is being transmitted along those tendons. And in a minute, hopefully this will make a little bit more sense if it doesn't right now. But because these muscle fibers are parallel, as the sarcomeres all shorten, and all they do is pull their Z lines together, right? And as they do that, all that force is being transmitted along that tendon. And that's a parallel arrangement of muscle fibers. It's also similar to the fusiform, which is basically the muscle kind of blends and the tendon kind of blend together, which is what the endomyosin and premyosin and all that do anyway. So that, for the most part, all of your tendons are again parallel and still producing force in the same line of pull. So parallel, all the sarcomeres are arranged and all the fibers are arranged so that the line of pull is the same as the function of your muscle fibers all together in the same plane. Remember that if you want to determine the physiological cross-sectional area of a muscle, it needs to be parallel. It needs to be a perpendicular slice through all of your muscle fibers, so that you can see the muscle fibers and you can quantify the physiological cross-sectional area, which equates to force production.
Right. Can you do that if you have an MRI? Or how do they do it?
Yeah, and they will do that. And you can MRIs have so many technologies now added to them that you can do all these additive components to it, but you can get pinnation angles and all those fun things with MRIs, and people do it now with ultrasound as well, as best they can. You get two-dimensional ultrasound, but you can make some... You can multiply the density of muscle times its area and the length of its fascicles and get a pretty good assumption, a very valid assumption, to the visual cross-sectional area of the muscle. I think those equations are in your textbook as well. Because we have to do that sometimes when we can't get all the parameters we need. So a fusiform muscle will have 100% of its force generated along the plane of movement, which is efficient. But they don't have huge cross-sectional areas. Hamstring muscles would be some of those examples in some way. Biceps brachii would be one. Sartorius muscle for sure is one. Has the longest fibers in your body. Yeah, Duran Duran. A pinnated muscle is one where the action of the fibers is not in the same plane as the pull and function of the tendons. I like mine pinnated. Some like theirs pinnated. It pulls in the literature, like moments and torques, the same thing. I go with the I because nobody else uses it as much as in Europe and Canada, not in Canada, so I go with pinnated. But pinnated means that there's only a percentage of force of the fibers is along the tendon line. Right? So as I've drawn these two tendons, attached the bone, the whole muscle tendon as a unit wants to pull in this direction, right? But where do the fibers want to go? The fibers want to pull in this direction. Therefore, only a fraction of the force of those fibers is going along the tendon line. So there's a lot of different things that happen in highly pinnated muscle. In fact, the force in your tendon is going to be the force of your fibers times the cosine theta, if this is theta. So the force that's going to be transmitted in this direction is going to be a cosine function, because if you think about the fact that this has force in that direction, go back to breaking down vectors, right? Vector algebra on vectors, good things. It's going to have a y component, and you're going to want the component x. And that's a cosine function of the angle. So a small percentage of this force that's generated by the muscle is actually going to be transmitted for movement. Now, the good thing about highly pinnated muscle fibers compared to fusiform or parallel arrangements is that even though you're losing a portion of the force in a different direction, the physiological cross-sectional area is huge. So, highly pinnated muscles allow you to stack a boatload of muscle fibers, albeit short muscle fibers, into a tiny space so that you can optimize gastrocnemius function and maybe not take up a whole lot of mass and space in the lower extremity and reduce inertia and attach it to a long tendon. You're going to lose some force because part of it is pulling in the wrong direction. We used to think. But you get a whole lot of muscle fibers in there. And what is best correlated to physiological cross-sectional area? Force. So these muscles, even though they may have short muscle fibers, have a lot of force. These are the larger force-producing muscles that you have in the body, even though they're short-fibered. Deltoid is a great example. The quadriceps, all the quad muscles are great examples as well. Divinated, they come with a lot of muscle fibers. They come with a lot of force. Now, one of the interesting things, like I said, we used to think that they were kind of a wash because we used to think that every time you did the eccentric contraction, they couldn't do much because they got short fibers and part of their orientation is off, so they're not actually generating force along the plane of movement. And that seems to be erroneous in many ways. I mean, there's just 2 years ago, a paper came out saying that there is a what you refer to as an architectural gearing ratio in muscle. It's like downshifting your car when you decide to do something. And what we do know is that when these muscles shorten, let's say these fibers shorten, therefore you produce a constant contraction. Obviously, this muscle is going to get a little bit skinnier in this regard, right? And it's going to shorten. But it also rotates, so the new orientation of these muscle fibers is actually like this. So you get a force production, but you also get this fiber rotation that takes place. And why that happens and the meaning of it is still a fascinating area of research. So these pronated muscles that we used to think were just there just for a little bit of stabilization force and a whole lot of cross-sectional area actually do a lot more things than we thought, because being able now with technology to be able to study these things in vivo in true life and real function is where it's more important, like we said, the jumping frog, than being able to see this real life and see how these fibers reorient themselves as the thing is shortening and as it lengthens as well. It's pretty cool. But architecturally, they're designed for high force, and because they have short fibers, they don't have a lot of excursion. So your parallel arrangement, your fusiform arrangement, because the fibers are longer, you get more movement with them. But you don't have a lot of cross-sectional areas, so you have a lot of force. And I covered this somewhat before, about starting here as a series of parallel, right? And about how it's indicative of function. So parallel arrangement, large physiological cross-sectional area gives you a lot of force, and that would be A on the top diagram. This would be a whole muscle, like we talked about in lab, when they have a whole muscle force length, it would be more of a torque angle relationship. Because you see this curve, it's not the typical Gordon Huxley and Julian change of slope, distinct plateau, etc. force length relationship. So it's a whole muscle force length or joint angle. And you'll see that if you have a muscle that is like this one, highly pinnated, produces a lot of force, therefore its peak is much higher than the other one, but it doesn't have very much extensibility, so its area on the x-axis is pretty small. Whereas if we had the muscle from before, we use a four muscle that really wasn't pinnated, has a smaller cross-sectional area, but longer muscle fibers, it's going to produce less maximum force, but it's going to do it over a greater range of force. This is usually the complementary pairs that you'll get in synergist muscles. You'll usually have one that is native and produces a little bit of force, and one that's long and skinny that gives you velocity of contraction and extensibility. You lose one, you change your function a great deal. But if you had to make a muscle to do both of those, like I said earlier, it would have to have the cross-sectional area of the pinnated muscle and the length of a fusiform or parallel muscle. And then you have a muscle that is 30 or 40% larger than the combined pair that you already have. Your force velocity profiles are on the bottom. Remember, at 0 degrees of movement is isometric contraction. And because we haven't normalized these guys, keep in mind that the physiological cross-sectional area is predictive of force. So this one has greater isometric force than that one does. So the force velocity profile starts here. B, we don't call him 100% force. A is going to produce about half of it because he has half the physiological cross-sectional area. Right? And then, what we can say like which one's fast and which one's slow. So, speed isometric force has nothing to do with velocity because it's 0 degrees of movement for whatever time you want. Which one has the maximal velocity of contraction? Okay. And that's always the key. The maximal velocity of contraction is going to be the faster twitch muscle, or the fast twitch fiber. Also, the curvature. Fast twitch fibers don't have the same curvature as the slow twitch does. So the curvature here is exaggerated compared to A. So, in this regard, again, the isometric force is due solely to cross-sectional area. The movement and the velocity and the force produced will be due to fiber typing, cross bridges, myosin ATPase, etc. Hypothetically. Theoretically. Maybe.
So, in theory, the bottom graph, they could be the same. They could have the same trajectory. Like.
Oh, no. So when you do these studies, remember, when you get to a point where you have increased the velocity and your force is, you've either controlled for one of these items, but you have got to the point where you have a velocity at which your force is essentially null. That's the end of it. So, right there where the A, sorry, where B ends about 5, right here, that is its force velocity profile. So it isn't going to ever go meet its friend and neighbor out there at 1.0.
Right, but like the muscles, muscle A and muscle B, just based on cross sectional area, hypothetically speaking, it could be a type 1 fiber or a type 2 fiber.
She's saying those two things are independent of each other.
They are, to a degree.
Right, so I'm just saying, like, hypothetically speaking, we're assuming that muscle A is a fast twitch fiber and muscle B is a slow twitch fiber.
Based on the profiles you see right here, that's what you would best go.
But hypothetically speaking, they could be the same or vice versa.
Well, how would they be the same? What would you want to do? So do you want to increase the cross-sectional area of A to B and see what happens? Or do you want to decrease the cross-sectional area of B to A and see what happens?
Take it there. Let's say they're both fast twitch as opposed to one.
So yeah, one could be faster than the other one?
I'm just saying, like, are we just assuming that a larger cross-sectional area is a slow twitch fiber?
No. What do we?
So they could be either.
So, no.
So confused.
Okay, that's what I'm here for.
Okay, good.
So I shouldn't say fast and slow, I should say which one's faster to do that. So let's first just say that. Which one has a capability of producing force faster? Which one is a faster twitch muscle fiber compared to the other? And we would say A over B.
Right.
Does that help?
Yeah, no, I get that.
Okay, so if I say I increase the cross-sectional area of A and I overlap these, I normalize it here. So now it still doesn't change its length. So now this curve goes all the way up and meets at 1.0 with A. We've got that. What does it change down here?
It just increases its force, but its velocity is the same.
Yeah, its force is 0. Because its contractile properties, its myosin ATPase, etc., doesn't change. So its force here will go up, but it still is going to end right here anyway. Right? Now, does that help?
I think maybe I'm phrasing my question wrong.
Wait, it's going to end.
It's going to end now.
Okay, that's what I'm just following
up. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Okay. It would maximize, so it would be 1.1.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
It would be the same thing for A.
It should not be.
So my question is irrelevant of the bottom graph.
Yep.
Hypothetically speaking, muscle A or muscle B could be fast twitch or slow twitch.
If you look at force length alone, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
And that would modify the bottom graph.
Exactly.
Okay, so we're just making the assumption based on the, or not the assumption, but based on the bottom graph, we know the fiber type. But hypothetically speaking, if we didn't have that graph, either could be fast twitch, either.
Looking at the top graph alone.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. Because isometric force does not care if you're slow or fast.
Okay.
Right. Now, so they're independent.
of each other.
So hypothetically speaking, they were both fast switch. Then the bottom graph both would look like A. Except the
Yes, except
the force.
They were both, if they both exact same fiber type and same velocity, then yes, they both ended 1.0.
Yeah.
Good. Makes sense.
Thank you.
Yes, it does, and there lies the rub. Muscle mechanists will argue that architectural properties are the most important determinant of the function of muscle fiber than anything, and muscle physiologists will say muscle physiology of the fiber is more important determinant than anything else. Screw the mechanists.
I don't like why this is bad.
It's the overall additive properties of an in-series element that's moving at the same velocity as its neighbors, right? So when you have one sarcomere that's moving at 1 millimeter per second, then we know that at the end of that one length change, 1 second goes by, it's going to be 1 millimeter short. Put another one in there that's moving also 1 millimeter per second. In 1 second, it's moving 2 millimeters per second. And that is the velocity, right? That's why. It's something that just happens to be a mathematical inevitability. So, velocity of contraction, the way we calculate velocity in this world, is dependent on an in-series element if it's going to produce force at a certain velocity. If we get back to limulus crabs living under the ocean and moving most of their time underwater, you can't move fast underwater. They have very few sarcomeres in series because they have some of the longest actin on the planet. They have actin that's up to 4 micrometers in length. So when they have a muscle fiber that you might have 100 sarcomeres in series, they got 25. Because they aren't concerned about the velocity of contraction. It's easier to keep alive, less metabolism, 25 sarcomeres than 100. And they can still move the entire excursion. It just takes them a quarter of the time, or 4 times the time.
Okay. It takes them more time.
Yeah. Because they gotta move 4 micrometers of actin through an overlap zone. Good luck with that. So this, all right? Okay. These are the two architecture of the most important graphs, right? Stuff like this, being able to look at that and go, This is your B, brachii, and B is brachii. A is your gas rock, and B is your soleus. Your soleus is one joint muscle. Right, so that's what makes fiber length. Fiber length is counteracted by multiple joint muscles because it gives you greater strength.
B is quads and A-samus.
B is quads, A-samus. That's true. But the hamstrings are not made for force production. They're made for high-velocity excursion, which I get on a soapbox of muscle mechanics and tell everybody that we're rehabilitating hamstrings completely incorrectly over the last 40 years, and the reason being is because they're afraid of knowing that they actually aren't supposed to be high-force muscles, so we put them on a leg curl machine and go, you don't need to do that with a hamstring. It's not made for that. It's made for long excursions and a lot of velocity. So, what time is it? I have a...
9:48.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, why did you yell at me?